This week on Underdogs, we're deep into the NBA and NHL playoffs, and we have our WNBA season preview.
And what would the underdogs be without actual dogs? That's right, we're taking our talents to Westminster.
The cry goes up both far and near for Underdog.
Underdog. Countdown going on right now. Morrow, up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. You believe in miracles? Yes!
By George, the dream is alive.
Underdog.
And I guess there's only one thing left to do. Win the whole fucking thing.
It's the Underdogs, back with you for another week. I'm Jordan Brenner, joined as always by my co-host and spectacular individual, Peter Keating. Peter, how are you handling all this sports excitement?
My pick just missed on the Kentucky Derby, Jordan. And so I'm looking to make it all back now based on the advice you're going to give me today about a different kind of race. So hopefully we can dog it today.
Oh, that's right. We've got a little dog treat for all of you. Yeah, we're going to look at the Westminster dog show at the end. Can't say I advise betting on it, but we found some cool trends we're going to talk about.
You're going to throw me a bone, Jordan?
I'll throw you a bone. We've got our WNBA season preview. But first, Peter, we are right in the thick of the NBA and NHL playoffs. And not just because we're in New York and this is the first like exciting spring in ages where both New York teams are still going, but I think there's a lot of cool comparisons to make between what's happening on the ice and what's happening on the hardwood.
Well, you know, one of my favorite things to say is we hate to say we told you so, but we love to say we told you so, didn't we? So let's start out with the top line, Jordan, which is that the New York Rangers and the Minnesota Timberwolves and the New York Knicks are all still in strong title contention, all previewed for you, brought to you and recommended for you by the Underdogs podcast. So let me just say that first.
So what's fascinating to me is you've got eight teams left.
Yes.
In both sports, right? But if you look at the championship odds on DraftKings, they tell two different stories. In the NBA, you have a prohibitive favorite in the Boston Celtics at plus 100. Then you jump to the Timberwolves at plus 320, who are up two games to none on the Nuggets, winning both on the road. The Thunder at plus 650, so already there. And then the five other teams, including the Knicks, are plus 1,000 or worse, okay? And then, you know, you got the Pacers and Cavaliers are plus 6,000, plus 20,000. Compare that to hockey, where the odds are so much flatter, okay? The Rangers, you have three teams at plus 425.
Right. Rangers, one of them's up, Oilers, one of them's up 2-0 in a second-round playoff series. They're still just plus 425.
Rangers, Oilers, and Avalanche. The Panthers are plus 650. The Bruins plus 700. The Stars plus 800. Even the Hurricanes are plus 1,000. They're down two games to none, which I just think speaks to the nature of these two sports, doesn't it?
Yes. Look, Jordan, we're talking on Wednesday morning. Last night, when I say last night, I mean Tuesday night. The Celtics won their 19th game this season by at least 25 points. Combine the regular season and postseason, that's the most of any team ever. Well, it's tied for the most, and they're not done yet. The thing is, that only takes the analysis one level deeper, because the question is, if a team were that dominant in hockey, what would it even look like? Would they even be able to win at the rate the Celtics are winning if they were literally as good compared to their competition as the Celtics are? It's a real basic primer here on the differences between the sports. You can establish dominance in almost any other sport in a way you just cannot do in hockey. Hockey is so much of a crapshoot. We're seeing it now, even when good teams can't really break away from the pack and the betting odds, or, you know, by the end of this postseason, we'll see they probably didn't even break away that heavily in any of the series involved.
So let's dig in a little more first on that NBA point, right? The Celtics, prohibitive favorite. I think we can agree now that this is their championship to lose, especially with the Nuggets crumbling, the Jamal Murray injury. We liked the Timberwolves, but I'm going to admit it, I did not foresee this situation with the Nuggets.
Look, I mean, every now and then a team builds to win a championship, their moves work, and then for one reason or another, largely coincidence, right? But every now and then it happens that all the dominoes start to fall where their rivals get hurt or have other kinds of problems and clear the path. This is what's happening with Boston this season.
But what's really interesting, we were talking about it just before the show, is that something outside of the Celtics that you don't see very often in the NBA is happening this year. Let's say the teams ahead in the series win. So the Knicks advance, the Thunder advance, and the Timberwolves advance. None of those three teams were even close to the top of the heap in preseason right. NBA championship odds. Peter, do you still have those numbers handy?
The Knicks were plus 5,000 preseason odds to win a championship. Mm-hmm. Minnesota plus 6,600. The Thunder plus 10,000. It's hard to believe now when you see them play they were ever plus 10,000 to win anything. But these were three extreme long shots making their way deep into the playoffs.
And so what I think you're seeing is a couple things. One, again, the NBA has been the most predictable sport in general over time. So what I think you're seeing is, one, the impact of youth, health, injuries. Obviously, it shook up a lot of what happened, both from what you the expected top teams and also these other teams. Two, the game is continuing to change. You can build differently. So star high-scoring guard now is a real model, whether it's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, whether it's Anthony Edwards, whether it's Jalen Brunson, right. You can win at a higher level than maybe 10 years ago with that team as a model. And the third thing is just that because officiating changed midway through the season here, it may have given certain types of teams a better chance than we thought earlier in the year.
Yeah, you were onto this months ago, right? Talking about how scoring is down and officiating has changed. And who has benefited, Jordan? The Knicks, who play extremely physically, and Minnesota, who has the best defense on a per point per 100 possession basis in the league. Clearly, they're not just playing better. They haven't just come together. They're also playing in an environment that suits them a little better, don't you think?
If freedom of movement is being restricted more now, okay, then you need a couple things. One, you need a creative one-on-one player who can, because if you're not able to move freely without the ball, you've got to be able to do things with the ball. And we mentioned Anthony Edwards, we mentioned Brunson, et cetera. The second thing is you could be more physical off the ball, which makes it harder for a team. Like in the past, Rudy Gobert might've been played off the floor. Okay. Now you can play those two bigs in Minnesota and not get spread out quite as much because you can bump and you can grind. You can do things to slow things down. I don't know what the answer is. The game keeps kind of flexing and changing to meet, scoring was out of control for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I still don't want to see players' movement restricted. But it is interesting to watch the game continue to evolve in front of our eyes.
You think it's all just officiating, though, or is it just a natural reaction to so many players being able to get into open space and score so often that defense has just tightened up? Like maybe this was just finally the year for the Minnesota experiment to maybe the Minnesota experiment would be working if everyone stayed healthy, and they kind of stayed healthy for the most part this year, and they got to do it, and people just undervalued the value of what they were doing.
I think it's a mixed bag. I don't think the Minnesota experiment of playing two bigs work without Karl Anthony Towns being such a great shooter and with Anthony Edwards becoming a transcendent superstar, right? If this was what we thought of them last year, it still doesn't work. But I do think that it's been aided. Their ability to play defense and play defense well has been aided by being able to be more physical. It's not one or the other. It's both.
Yeah, and we should probably give a little credit to the Knicks' development of talent. I mean, the other way to get really good really fast is to get players who turn out to be a lot better or who you make a lot better than anyone thought they were. And that's true about Josh Hart. It's true about DiVincenzo. It's true about Hartenstein. The guys they've surrounded Brunson with are playing way better than I expected. And I expect them to play pretty well, but you expect them to play this well without Julius Randle? I mean, we should give some credit to the development aspect of this.
Knicks fans were upset that they traded Cam Reddish for Josh Hart. Remember that one?
I do.
But look, I think it's really cool when a team can make moves with role players and get better. And that's what they've done. It's just not been the paradigm in the NBA. It has been the paradigm in hockey, for sure. And I'm just getting back to those flat odds. Obviously, we're a Rangers fan show, but to quote the great John Sterling, you can't predict hockey, Susan. Like, I still don't know how to make sense of this. And do we have a favorite underdog left? How do you make sense of this?
I actually am still in the confusion stage because the only way I've been able to make sense about hockey through analytics in the past is to just filter out everything that you can say is either accidental or a low, small sample size, and look at shot volume. Well, nobody plays shot volume better than Carolina,
yeah,
right? And we talked about how Carolina had a game where they took 110 shots and gave up 28 to the Islanders. Carolina in game two against the Rangers, again, outshot the Rangers, again, couldn't score that winning goal. And the Rangers again scored, I think twice, right, on power plays. Are we ready to say that power play goals shouldn't be discounted, like you might, let's say, third down performance in the NFL, as just being small sample size? Because the Rangers keep getting an inordinate percentage of their shots and special teams and scoring a lot and giving up nothing. And that has so far not just neutralized, but triumphed over Carolina's advantage in shot volume. And so what are we left with to make, like, to finally say power plays are a small sample size, but we've got to believe in them? So here I am. I am analytically bereft. I mean, I like the Rangers, but I, you know, the rational side of my brain can't keep believing what's going to go on is going to continue.
Right. Look, I think what we can say is not all shots are created equally, right? So presumably you're getting better shot attempts on the power play, but look, it's trite, but it's true. The goalie is the great equalizer, right? And that's why, you know, it's very hard to wave off anyone's chances remaining if the goalie can get hot.
But yeah, but you know, Jordan, who is hotter than Frederik Andersen? I think what we need are some of the stats that soccer has about who carries the puck. Like soccer, you get who carries the ball from zone to zone, right? Who carries and passes the ball so well from one zone to another that it sets up extremely high quality shots. Clearly, that's something the Rangers are capable of doing and executing, and we need better data on that.
Well, you know who's hotter than Frederik Andersen, Peter? You know what's hotter than everything in sports right now?
Zibanejad?
That's right.
Oh.
Women's basketball.
Oh, sure.
Now, the WNBA, and we will be back to talk about the upcoming season right after this.
Underdog. 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 Underdog.
We're back, and we are excited to talk about the WNBA. I got swept up in the excitement of the college season. I've been doing as much research as I can. I'm preparing to play WNBA fantasy basketball, and I want to make this announcement to all our listeners. It is a great time to get into the game. Don't feel guilty if you haven't followed it so far. It's not like, oh, you're not the cool Taylor Swift fan who knows her deep cuts. Just jump in and have fun, baby. So that's what we're going to do together. We're going to play fantasy this year. We're going to gamble during the summer. Let's go, Peter.
I want a recording of Jordan on a button where he says, let's just jump in and have fun, baby. We have to be able to replay that at a moment's notice. I'll tell you this. I have followed WNBA, and I admit, yes, it's partly ideological. I liked when the NBA started investing in women. I hated the arguments against it. I hated the fact that talented players would come out of college and have to go play in, like, some unknown town in the Ural Mountains and rupture all their tendons just to make a living. And you know what? High time that we start paying attention to the people in the world who are the best at what they do. That's what I think.
All right, so let's start with the theme of our show, okay? The WNBA, you could call it no country for underdogs right now, okay? Because it is a top heavy league. We talked about last year how they built two super teams, the Las Vegas Aces, who won the championship, the New York Liberty, who fell short in the finals. This year, Seattle may be joining them in close to super team area. But, Peter, it's really hard to think of anyone else even competing for a championship outside of the Aces or the Liberty, with maybe the Storm and the Sun trying their best.
Yeah, Jordan, there's a couple of obviously great teams, and there's a lot of great talent coming into the league, but teams did a really good job in this draft of meeting needs so that a lot of talent has flowed to the bottom of the league. So I think your super teams are still going to be by far the favorites to win a championship, but it's going to be hard for them to be so far above average again. I mean, the number of the Aces over under on wins is 33.5 in a 40 game season. I think those teams are going to come back to the pack a little. I think the worst teams, maybe not the very, very worst teams, because there's always a chance, you know, that you're going to get a tanking race to the bottom because Paige Beckers is the number one pick this year. But I think there's going to be a vast middle. And what people should understand is that's good because there's more talent among more teams. There's just a lot more good players right now in the WNBA than there have ever been before.
So totally agree on that point. And it's why, you know, you see a lot of talk about expansion and the league.
Right.
It's ready. It's ready to move into some more cities. It's ready to disperse these players a little more and break up the glut at the top. But here's the thing. I think the bottom three teams are really going to be terrible. The Sparks, the Mystics, and the Sky. So I'm not sure this is the year where the standings compact. I mean, the Aces are still just better than everyone, and the Liberty are probably better than everyone after that. So I'm having trouble picking out a mid-pack team that could make a surprising run. Now, if you look at betting odds, the team that's most out of whack with sort of how good they were last year and where they're projected this year, the Indiana Fever have the fifth highest title or fifth shortest title odds, I should say. Peter, what could have possibly changed in Indiana that might make teams think they're going to be better this year?
I hate to say this because I you know, we understand all the emotional reasons and all the actual intensity of fan interest reasons why something gets overvalued. When the whole world is zigging for reasons you can't really identify all that well, it's time to zag. If Indiana's 500 this year, it'll be a great accomplishment. Caitlin Clark's going to be there. But Jordan, there's limits to what any one woman, even someone as great as Caitlin Clark, even someone paired with Aaliyah, you know, it's going to be a great combination there is what I'm trying to say. But if they get to 500, it's going to be a great achievement.
Right.
You don't need to start talking about them as championship contenders just yet. I myself was I love what the Chicago Sky did in getting Camila Cardoso and Angel Reese in the draft. But Jordan, they may win 10 games this year. I mean, with Cardoso injured. I mean, you can't take all that enthusiasm and predict a title.
Well, one thing at a time. So Indiana, and I'm actually writing an article for The Athletic this week as well about why maybe the worst bet on the board right now is the Caitlin Clark MVP. She's plus 1,200 to win the MVP. That's the fourth shortest odds. Not to go all Diana Taurasi, but there's no way this year. Look, she may not even be the best player on her own team this year with Aaliyah Boston. And then I'll go into more detail in the article, but the bottom line is MVPs in all sports, particularly this sport, come from the best teams. And no matter how transcendent Caitlin Clark is this year, they'll be hard pressed to get past the Liberty or the Aces. Voters aren't going to, you know, unless she averages 30 and 15, which isn't going to happen, she's not getting MVP votes as a rookie over players on the best teams.
Well, Jordan, they also need to be two-way players. I mean, you can tell outstanding defense in the WNBA. That's where the eye test does measure up with the analytics. I mean, if you look at just something basically as simple advanced stats like offensive and defensive win shares, and you look at players who have dominated the league, Breanna Stewart, Asia Wilson, Elena Deladon, about a third of their value comes from defense. And it's possible Caitlin Clark will transform everything and be the next Steph Curry. It's a tall order to bet on it happening in 1 year. We don't know what her defensive value is going to be with a bad team. And so people really have to understand it's not an insult to say don't bet on her to be the MVP just yet.
There's been one rookie to win MVP in WNBA history. It was Candace Parker in 2008. And by the way, that year she led the league in rebounding, averaged over two blocks and a steal per game. So like you said,
I was just going to say tremendous improvement, great team, two-way player, rebounder also. Who the hell else were they going to give the award to? This year, that question has a lot of answers, or is likely to have a lot.
So if Indiana is not the team to vault into, say, the top three, to present the greatest challenge to the two super teams outside of the Aces and Liberty, who is the most interesting of the others to you?
Jordan, I kind of like the unders, not picking a team to leap into contention.
So nobody. Okay.
I think people are boosting Phoenix's odds to be almost a 500 team, but Diana Taurasi is a little older and Brittany Griner hasn't been dominant for a while. And they traded for Kalia Copper and she was the finals MVP one season, but she's not an efficient shooter. And I think they're a little overvalued. I would have liked Dallas, but you know, Sabaly's out for something like half the year, right? With an injury. And here's the thing also, there are no WNB teams who were seriously out of whack with their point differential last year. There's no team that you'd say, oh, this team, like we see in the NFL all the time in a short schedule. There's no team we would say, oh, this team played so well, we would have expected them to do a lot better, and therefore they're due. As a matter of fact, even the Aces played better before Candace Parker got hurt. And so I think we're in for a little compression. I don't know if there's going to be a breakout team. I guess I like the Liberty to win a championship, but they're already the second shortest odds.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the third potential super team then. The most variance, I think, is Seattle, right? Because the hardest thing to project is how new players will mesh together. The Liberty made a bunch of moves last year, and if you look at their stats, their scoring differential, their efficiency, all markedly improved over the second half of the season. Don't forget the NBA, WNBA, yes. Very short preseason, very little time to integrate rookies, and then the regular season is short. So a team can't improve over the year as much as in some of the other sports. But How is Seattle going to fit all this together? Okay. You've got the returning leading scorer in the league in Jewel Lloyd. You're adding Skylar Diggins-Smith in the backcourt. You're adding Nneka Okumike. That team has talent, and it's the fun part of sports. Why, right? Watching the experiment of fitting talented parts together and seeing how quickly they become greater than the sum of their parts.
I completely agree. Like, you can watch LA or Chicago try to piece their new pieces together, but they're going to be dreadful teams, right? Seattle has a chance to be really good watching these players come together. And I think they're going to be the most entertaining team to watch. And if you want to take a flyer on them. Who else?
The other interesting team is Phoenix, right? They have big names who are old, led by Diana Taurasi, obviously, Brittany Griner. So the question, right, is there one last run left in them? Obviously, things didn't go so well last year, but can these, you know, inspired by the whatever is fueling Diana Taurasi these days, is there any fuel left in the tank to maybe pull off a big upset?
I feel a little bit more like they're going to be the Milwaukee Bucks, you know, like they have it in them to play exceptionally well, and you're going to see some flashes of transcendent talent, but they really going to catch the Liberty, beat the Liberty or the Aces, especially in the postseason. How can I put this? I think there's a better chance they'll go completely bust and that they will take off and surprise everybody and win 25 games.
Right. You know, and again, it just, in the end, we talk about all of this, but it's just so hard for me to see anybody stopping an Aces three-peat. They're just so good, so balanced. They won the finals last year with key players injured. I don't think Candace Parker's retirement is going to hinder them, you know. Clearly, playing catch with me on vacation is what spurred her to retire. There was no no greater highlight in her life than throwing a football with my mom in the pool. But
But Jordan, you know, team. We talked about how everything got cleared out of the way for the Celtics. I mean, to win over 33 and a half games and to win another championship, they have to stay healthy. And I still don't even know if it's Chelsea Gray healthy. We haven't seen her since the finals. I think she's healthy, but I'm not sure. And you have to not get old fast, and you can't have any competitors who come together really fast. It's tough to do three in a row. It's tough to do in an era where dominance, dare I say, is probably declining a little because overall play is improving. I'll say one other thing. This is probably a great year to be in a WNBA fantasy league because then you can pick players and follow them and track them, not worry about all these players who have gone to teams that are probably going to be dreadful for a while and follow it that way.
Peter, what would the Underdogs podcast be if we didn't talk about the biggest dog event in all of sports, the Westminster Dog Show?
Jordan, I hope you fetched us some interesting numbers here to discuss.
Oh, I did. And I'm going to be a very good boy for the next 3 minutes.
we'll put your dish down after this.
So first of all, I would like to make some picks about specific dogs, but they don't actually tell you which individuals are competing. Now, I know there's 47 golden retrievers and things like that, but let's talk about
47.
Yeah, but let's talk about breeds and groups, okay? So the way this works, there are seven different groups. The terrier group, the sporting group, the working group, the toy group, the non-sporting group, the hound group, and the herding group, okay? The winner of each of the seven groups then advances to compete for best in show.
Can I ask you a quick question? I understand what herders do. What does the what does the sporting group do?
And that the non-sporting group does?
That you what? How do you end up in non-sporting if you don't fit into any other category? Like, what's a non-sporting dog? A dog who lies around?
They cheat, obviously. They're bad sports. Okay. Now, here, since 1989, best in show, there has been a repeat winner from the same group four times. In other words, like 2 years in a row, the hounds won, or 2 years in a row, the terriers won, okay?
Yeah.
But there's been no repeat breed winner. Okay. But the hounds are going for a three-peat this year. So that's big news. And that's also interesting because over time, terriers have won 46 of the championships. It's a
I have one more question. Is this like saying players from the Angels are likely to win the MVP because it's always Mike Trout? Is this the same dog coming back year after year? Or once you win, can you not come back?
No, you can come back, but there's been no repeat dog winner in ages.
So no dog returns to claim the crown second. Okay. All right. Not even Uno the Beagle. I remember Uno the Beagle. Yeah.
You will see that winning groups. But so that's number one. Can the Hounds get the three-peat? The underdog is the working group, which hasn't won best in show since 2004, although the herding group is the worst all time with only three wins compared to the Terriers, 46. Now,
so I have to say that sounds pretty elitist. Like, if you're not going to reward the workers and the herders, like that doesn't seem cool. So sheep don't win.
Real quick, I want to get into the groups because very little time to keep yapping on about this, but there've been a fair number of repeat winners, but most of the time it's the same dog. It's very rare for the breed to win back to back if it's not the same dog. So for instance, since 89, in the seven group winners, there have been 29 repeat dogs, including 4 3-peats, but only 8 back-to-back breed wins from different dogs. What does this tell me? The judges like to mix it up, but they fall in love with specific dogs. So be on the lookout for returning winners in the groups. But if there's no returning winner in that group, pivot to a different breed. And that's my advice. The Underdogs Podcast is a production of Meadowlark Media and the DraftKings Network. Our show is produced by Sarah McCrory. Our executive producer is Neely Lohman. Follow us on Twitter at PeterKeatingNJ and at Jordan Brenner. Tell a friend and subscribe to the Underdogs Podcast anywhere you like to listen, and be sure to tune in again next week.